I will call this remote hearing of the Judiciary Finance and Civil Law Committee to order. Today is February 8th, 2022, and we are holding this meeting remotely per Rule 10.01. I've been notified that a quorum is present. The clerk will take the roll. Anna, please go ahead.
Chair Beckerfin.
Present.
Vice Chair Moeller.
Present.
Representative Scott.
Present.
Representative Feist.
Present.
Representative Frazier.
Present.
Representative Grossel.
Present.
Representative Herr.
Present.
Representative Hollins.
Present.
Representative Johnson. Representative Johnson. Representative Liebling.
Present.
Present.
Oh, Representative Johnson, present. Representative Liebling, present.
Present.
Representative Long. Representative Long. Representative Mortensen.
Present.
Representative Novotny.
Present.
Representative Farr.
Present.
Representative Robbins.
Present.
Representative Vang.
Present.
And Representative Zhang.
All right, more than a quorum. So the first thing we'll do today is move the minutes. Do I have a motion to approve the minutes of February 3rd, 2022?
So moved, Madam Chair.
All right, Representative Frazier moves the minutes of February 3rd, 2022. Any discussion to the minutes? All right, seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Aye.
Opposed? All right, the minutes are approved. So we have a really, we have a lot of people from the public who want to participate in our committee today, and that's a really good thing. But with that, we have a lot to do today. So we have before us today, we're going to start with House File 341. Representative Feist, would you like to move 341 be re-referred to the Education Policy Committee?
Yes, I would, Madam Chair.
So right. Representative Feist moves House File 341. We have several amendments this morning. I believe they are all author's amendments. So we will take care of those first. First up, we have the A1 amendment. In the interest of time, I'm just going to move the A1 amendment myself instead of kicking it over to you for every single one of these, Representative Feist. So I will move the A1 amendment and then we'll move the amendment to the A1 amendment. I believe there's a small oral amendment, Representative Feist, to the amendment to the A1 amendment, if you could explain your oral amendment for the record.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. The A1 amendment is offered after conversations with the College Board to ensure that the bill does not unintentionally affect students in Minnesota from accessing post-secondary planning and supports. I would like to amend the amendment at line 1.6. Currently, it reads that express written consent is required. I would like to amend line 1.6 to read express digital or written consent.
All right, any discussion to the amendment to the amendment? All right, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed? All right, the amendment to the amendment is adopted. So now to the underlying A1 amendment as amended, Representative Feist, please briefly explain your amendment.
Yep. So basically, in collaboration with the College Board, we just wanted to make sure that that the students would, when they took like ACT, SAT, that this College Board would be able to, you know, approach them with scholarships and educational supports based on their scores. And so that is why we made this amendment.
All right. Sounds good. Any discussion to the A1 amendment as amended? Seeing none, all those in favor of the A1 as amended, please say aye.
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 Opposed? All right, the A1 as amended is adopted. We will move on to the A2 amendment. I will move the A2 amendment. Representative Feist, please explain the A2.
Yes. So the A2 amendment was made in collaboration with school stakeholders to clarify language around remote access to school issued devices for non-commercial educational purposes in instances where the device is stolen and where it is required to comply with federal or state law or to participate in federal or state funding programs.
All right. Any discussion to the A2 amendment? All right. Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? All right, the A2 amendment is adopted. Moving on to the A3, I will move the A3 amendment, and I can actually explain this one. It's just updating the effective dates because this bill was introduced last year. Any discussion to the A3? All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? All right, the A3 amendment is adopted. And finally, the A4 amendment. I will move the A4 amendment, and Representative Feist, a brief description of the A4, please.
Yes, the A4 amendment takes non-public schools out of coverage by the bill. This decision was made because the constitutional issues are not the same for non-governmental actors, and students at non-public schools don't have to choose between their privacy and a K-12 education. They have the option to switch to a public school if they prefer.
All right. Any discussion to the A4 amendment? All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? All right. The A4 amendment is adopted. Your bill is now in the shape that you would like it to be in. Representative Feist, thank you for your quick descriptions of the bills. And with that, I will Representative Feist renews her motion that House File 341 as amended be referred to the Education Policy Committee. And now you can present your bill. Representative Feist, please go ahead.
Great. Thank you, Madam Chair. And I would just mention that we are also working on a handful of technical edits in response to some helpful input by data privacy experts. Those will be pretty technical. So I am thrilled to be presenting the Student Data Privacy Act to the Judiciary Committee today. This bill recently passed out of the bipartisan bicameral Commission on Data Practices with full unanimous support. This act originally was introduced in 2015 and over the years has been amended to thoughtfully incorporate feedback from stakeholders. The version before you today is a reasonable, targeted bill crafted to achieve its goal, to bring our student data privacy laws into the 21st century. As a mother of a 10 and 11-year-old, I have been inundated with demands by my kids' schools that I sign up for numerous external vendors. Through these portals and programs and cloud databases, my children interact on camera with peers and upload their writing projects and photos of their belongings and our home. Last summer, my daughter continued to access her school-created Google Doc to work on her epic magic mermaid saga. I have no idea who reads her mermaid stories besides me and when this content will be destroyed, if ever. I also have no idea where or if photographs of our home and my children are saved somewhere and who has access to that data. I have also seen firsthand how companies profit off of our children's educational data. My daughter's class used an in-class math game that relentlessly marketed to the children to pressure their parents for a paid subscription. We finally gave in and found out that our daughter's in-class version of the game would incorporate new princess dresses and a fancy home. In addition, we were mortified that the way this would impact classmates without paid subscription. In addition, a recent study found that this particular program does not enhance math preparedness and rather serves only to increase screen time for kids. This incident illustrates clearly why our data privacy laws need to address the modern realities of how technology providers profit off of our kids' data. You received written testimony today from Minnesota mother who requested the data maintained by her child's school only to find out that amongst the countless documents and photographs and videos were photographs of her bedroom and clips of her yoga videos. The amount and type of data modern day schools now interact with is mind-boggling. And yet the laws designed to protect this data envisions it as exclusively pieces of paper in a locked filing cabinet. The status quo is the Wild West when it comes to protecting student data. If we are to believe the principle that our children do not shed their constitutional rights at the schoolhouse gate, then we must do better. We must protect access to data and the unscrupulous use of data to target our children for profit. We must protect children from unconstitutional and unequal surveillance that has already led to discriminatory disciplinary actions against students of color and has undermined the ability of mental health professionals to effectively effectively reach and help students in need. The pandemic and the resulting sudden and dramatic expansion of remote learning has exacerbated an already urgent situation, and the time to act is now. The Student Data Privacy Act will create uniformity of protections for our students as follows. First, the bill requires that contracts between schools and external technology providers include provisions that will protect access to student data, destroy data upon conclusion of the contract, and that breaches will be disclosed. Second, the bill limits school surveillance of student activities on school-issued devices. Notably, numerous exceptions to this provision are incorporated into the bill, including where surveillance is necessary to respond to an imminent threat of life to life or safety. Lastly, this bill would limit the ability of external technology providers to utilize student data for a commercial purpose, including but not limited to marketing or advertising to a student or parent. I look forward to this discussion of this important bipartisan effort to update Minnesota's student data privacy laws to the modern world. This bill exemplifies good governance, principled support for students' and parents' constitutional rights, the ongoing effort to ensure that all children in Minnesota have the same educational resources and protections, and it draws a line in the sand that says our children's data is not for sale. It has been a privilege to work on this bill alongside its supporters, including the ACLU of Minnesota, Education Minnesota, the Student Data Privacy Project, and local nonprofit Youth Prize, which advocates for Minnesota students and youth. Thank you for taking the time to hear this bill today.
Thank you, Representative Feist. And I know that this has been an effort years in the making that I believe Representative Lucero has been working on as well. With that, we'll go to the testifiers. For our testifiers, there are a lot of you today. And in order to respect your fellow testifiers, so that everybody has an equal amount of time, you will each get 2 minutes. So if you can try to keep to the point and keep focused, we would all really appreciate that. First on the list, I have Rich Neumeister. If you could unmute yourself, introduce yourself for the record, and then go ahead with your testimony.
Good morning, Madam Chair. My name is Rich Neumeister. I have interacted with Representative Feist over the last several weeks. I shared with her some detail, some technical and some that people might say is technical, but still can have an impact on the bill. And those are the four areas. I won't get into the technical things that I've suggested, but at least four areas. I'll be referring to the bill as introduced. Two of those issues are definitional. If you take a look at lines 1-8 through 111, there's a change of the definition of educational data. Why this concerns me is that definitions are a very strong part of operations to understand a statute. This particular definition has been part of law for 40 years. The additional language that is added is already covered under current law. And so based on my experience of 40 plus years of interacting with language, particularly with a statute such as the Minnesota Government Data Practices Act, I would suggest to keep the current definition. And I know that there are other parties that have shared that concern with Representative Feist, and that's still, I guess, an ongoing issue. The second item, the parent definition. The parent definition is distinctly different than the federal law that's being proposed in the state law. And maybe Representative Feist can talk about that, but the federal definition, again, has been around a long time, and it allows for a greater situation where people that may act as parents may not have the legal authority, but can access the student's data. Number three is an area that I just, particularly when you look at lines 3.25 and 4.8, there are a lot of things that new laws, new accountabilities, new things that parents are need to be told about. One of the things that I feel in that section, there is not a strong notice that should be given. I think there can be language adopted that says this notice that's going to be given to parents and students too must be conspicuous, must be outside of the general, in the handbook that's generally distributed, separate somehow, some way, so that parents know this important part of law that's being adopted. As Representative Feist indicated, this is a big deal. And the fourth point is that, and I shared this with Representative Feist, and particularly when she was making comments again to illustrate how important this is and all the obligations that are going to be done, I've asked myself, how is it going to be enforced? How is it going to be the school district and going to be able to know if things are happening? So I am suggesting some type of auditing, reporting be done. I know that with the points that I've raised, Representative Feist, Madam Chair, has indicated that it was not able to come to this first stop, and that at the next stop at the Education Committee, some of those concerns might be more smoothed out or adopted or whatever. So, Madam Chair, thank you very much. I just wanted to share my concerns and some of those items that are still ongoing.
Yep. Thank you for your testimony. I will note for our other testifiers, that was like 4 minutes, but I know that Mr. Neumeister has been working on this quite a bit, and so allowed him to go over his full testimony. Moving on, we will go to Andrew Liddell. If you could unmute yourself, introduce yourself for the record, and then go ahead with your testimony.
Good morning, Madam Chair and Representatives. My name is Andrew Liddell, and I'm a technology lawyer and digital rights activist from Austin, Texas, where I live with my wife and two young kids. And I'm here today to testify in favor of HF 341. I co-founded the Student Data Privacy Project, which is a grassroots parent effort to understand what information is being collected about our kids by tech vendors and what is being done with it. Last year, we coordinated an effort by 14 families in 9 states to exercise their information access rights under the 1974 federal FERPA law. And what we learned was shocking. Despite clear requirements to make this information available to parents upon request and to limit to whom that information is given and how it can be used, not a single school district from Alaska to Maryland gave parents the information they're legally entitled to within the time limits required by law. Here in Minnesota, as Representative Feist mentioned, one family received over 2,000 files about their young daughter, representing just a small portion of what was requested, but which included such things as baby pictures, videos of her in an online yoga class, her artwork, and answers to in-class questions. The family was given no information about how long this information was to be stored, to whom it was disclosed, or for what purposes it was being used. Today's digital products, including those used in school, collect a staggering amount of information about their users. This includes grades for every assignment and disciplinary records going back to kindergarten. It includes every search, every website you visit, and every person you interact with. It also includes every mouse movement, how long you linger on an image. Truly, every single thing you do on a computer, all of this information is fed into an algorithm that is used to build a digital model of you. This digital you not only determines what you experience in the digital world, but also what opportunities you have in the real world. And everything a child does on a computer for 13 years they're in school is subject to being collected in this way. And while this vast trove presents risks for hackers, I'm most concerned about how the currently legal uses of this information are shaping this generation of young people. These digital models of our kids are used in life-altering ways, including to determine which students will be recruited by a selective college and which will be referred to the local police. Currently, there are no practical limits to how this information is used and no assurances that this information is accurate before it is disclosed to those who make profound decisions about our kids' futures. HF 341 creates a healthier digital ecosystem for the school children of Minnesota by legislating that student data is not the property of technology vendors and limiting how that data can be used, and by sharply curtailing the surveillance of students. This bill safeguards the freedom and self-determination of the children of your state. I urge you to support it. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Next on the list, I have Julia Decker. If you can unmute yourself, introduce yourself for the record, and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Julia Decker, Policy Director for the ACLU of Minnesota. We are here to testify in support of HF 341 as an urgently needed step in the right direction towards protecting student data privacy in Minnesota. We're really grateful to Representative Feist for chief authoring this bill and to Representatives Lucero and Representative Scott for their ongoing work and expertise in the subject area. As you've heard, HF 341 promotes transparency for students and their parents around technology that schools are using. It limits what schools and tech companies can do with student information, and it prohibits the use of certain technologies that present the most egregious threats to civil liberties. This bill has been a work in progress for a number of years now, but the move to remote learning during COVID-19 has renewed focus on the issue. The reality is that new technology with serious implications for civil liberties is being deployed and developed far more rapidly than laws can keep up with. And by the time decision makers such as the legislature try to grapple with this, it's virtually impossible to pull the technology back because it has become so pervasive. Just because technology is making it easier and easier to do things that can infringe, encroach on, and even violate civil liberties, that should not translate to a meek acceptance that civil liberties are thereby diminished or downsized as a result. So ACLU of Minnesota urges you to pass HF 341 to update the guardrails for students' data privacy and to do so this session. But we also urge you to explore forward-looking oversight and transparency mechanisms in order to move Minnesota's stance on technology and data privacy from reactive to proactive. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Next on the list, I have Sarah Cluck. Please introduce yourself for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Good morning. Hello and happy Tuesday. My name is Sarah Cluck and I'm the Senior Director of Education Policy at the Software and Information Industry Association, a nonprofit trade association representing education technology companies. I'm the proud graduate of Minnesota's public schools and the daughter of a retired paraprofessional in District 834, as well as a former fellow at the U.S. Department of Education focusing on the Family Educational Rights and Privacy Act, which is has already been mentioned many times here. But let me give you a little bit of background on FERPA. It is a federal law which protects student data privacy in the classroom. In the vast majority of situations, there is typically a contract between a technology company and a school whenever that technology company has access to student data. FERPA requires data access by technology companies to only be used for the purpose it was disclosed and that data remain under the direct control of the school. If a tech company does not abide by that contract with the school that outlines these provisions required by FERPA, then the school could be banned from using that tech for 5 years. No tech company, and speaking on behalf of the tech companies that I represent, no tech company wants a press release out there saying that their product was banned from a school for 5 years. I appreciate the leadership of Representative Feist and Lucero and Scott to protect student data privacy in Minnesota. I've testified on this bill several times over the years and appreciate the work being done to refine the bill. I still have some concerns about certain sections that are as written, so I'm happy to work with the sponsors to find consensus on this. A couple of examples, I remain concerned about the, as introduced, lines 323 and 324, which require technology companies to make security procedures available as public data. Making those security procedures available as public data increases the risk of a security incident that could put student data across Minnesota at risk. I also am concerned about lines 4.13 to 4.3, which allow a parent or student to effectively opt out of certain technology providers in the classroom. This provision could place an undue burden on Minnesota's teachers, requiring them to learn and use different tools for every student in a class. To paint a picture, if this law was in effect in April 2020, we may have seen teachers needing to hold a math class on Zoom for one group of students, on WebEx for another group of students, on Google Hangouts for another group of students. You get the picture. This would place an incredible burden on Minnesota's teachers and stretch the already limited time they have. There's a few other areas of concern, but knowing that I only have 2 minutes, I just wanted to outline that. Thank you for your time, and happy to see everyone's smiling faces this Tuesday morning.
Thank you for your testimony. And I know for folks who do have feedback, I know that Representative Feist is dedicated to making sure that this is the best bill it can be. So keep having those conversations because this is going to education policy. Next up, I have Anthony Padernos. Please introduce yourself for the record and then go ahead with your testimony.
Good morning. Myself and Eric Simmons will be jointly doing this testimony. Good morning. I'm Anthony Paternus, the Executive Director of Technology for Osseo Area Schools. My colleague, Eric Simmons, and I are happy to be here today on behalf of K-12 education technology leaders from across Minnesota. As members of MASA, the Minnesota Association of School Administrators, and the statewide Minnesota K-12 Technology Leadership Group to share with you our thoughts around this proposed bill. As we shared with the Legislative Commission on Data Practices in October, K-12 education technology leaders across the state have a common interest in securing the privacy and data of our students, staff, and families. We agree with the intent and parts of this bill and are strong supporters of providing greater protections by holding technology vendors accountable and to high standards for ensuring privacy and data security. We have partnered with Representative Feist around the language of this bill and want to thank her for continuing to work with us. Our group appreciates the amended changes, including language around E-rate mandates and lost stolen district technologies. However, we continue to have challenges with the current language as it relates to the duty as school districts we have for educating students and providing a safe and welcoming environment. Minnesota districts have board policies, state laws, federal laws, and codes of ethics regarding how we as school districts and district employees are responsible for ensuring data privacy and protections. Many examples that have come up in the media over the years relating to technology use overreach by school officials are often already prohibited by these policies and laws. They are often examples of employee misuse of digital tools rather than districts' authority to access digital information. I would like to hand it over to Eric Simmons to provide more detail around our primary concerns with this bill as currently proposed.
Good morning, and thank you, Chair Beckerfin and representatives. I'm Eric Simmons, Director of Technology at Chistago Lakes School District. As my colleague Anthony Paternos introduced, pre-K through 12 education leaders continue to have concerns for both the school-issued device monitoring and opt-out sections of this bill. It conflicts with our day-to-day operations and conflicts with our charge to use student learning data in a positive way to support every student across the state. First, this bill's proposed opt-out provisions for technology would create major disruptions to basic school functions that are not feasible. For example, most aspects of school management like report cards, transcripts, GPA calculations, class ranks, and even scheduling students into classes occurs within a school information system and often more than one that needs to talk with one another. For teachers using digital curriculum, student opt-outs would require alternative lesson plans and content. The burden of alternatives for opted out students would fall on teachers to consider daily a second set of lesson plans for students who have opted out of specific tools. If the opt outs actually secured student data, these challenges may be worth it. However, student opt outs have no bearing on the overall security of our school data. In the school issued device section, the bill restricts technology providers from monitoring student use, which we agree with, but the bill also extends restrictions to school personnel, which would put Minnesota students at a disadvantage. We support restricting technology providers, but school personnel also bear responsibilities that vendors do not have. We must maintain safe and supportive learning environments, help students develop responsible digital citizenship habits, and enforce our acceptable use policies. The language of this bill would prohibit school employees from investigating student inappropriate use, behavior, cyberbullying, and other non-criminal matters by using warrants or life-threatening emergencies as the standards for looking into student misconduct. Unfortunately, behavior or peer misconduct that does not reach these levels is a very often occurrence in our school systems. Finally, the Minnesota Safe and Supportive Schools Act requires schools to investigate and respond to acts of cyberbullying. It specifically calls out the need for schools to investigate when student technology use off the school premises impacts student learning during the school day and conflicts with this bill. We do share common interests in protecting student data privacy, and we support protecting student data privacy in a manner that does not severely restrict the other aspects of our charge in education. We appreciate Representative Feist's time discussing challenges and a start towards amendments. We continue to have challenges with this bill as it relates to the duty we have for educating all students and providing a safe learning environment. Thank you, Jeb Beckerfin, and the rest of this committee for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. Next, we have Tyler Dyer. If you could introduce yourself for the record and then go ahead with your testimony.
Yes, good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Tyler Dears, and I serve as the Midwest Executive Director for TechNet. Thank you for allowing me to be here. We are a technology trade association, and I'm here before in opposition to House File 341, again, as stated previously, as introduced. TechNet and our member companies that operate in the student data technology space agree with Representative Feist that student data privacy is a priority, which is why we have worked diligently with policymakers and states across the country to ensure that student data privacy is protected. As drafted, the bill does introduce several overbroad definitions. For example, commercial purposes is not defined beyond including, but not limited to marketing or advertising to a student or parent. We believe that with this little guidance in the bill, the burden to determine what constitutes as commercial purposes will be shifted onto technology providers to decipher, but with no guarantee that they make the right call. Additionally, under the bill, a technology provider is required to not sell, share, or disseminate educational data unless agreed upon with a public educational agency or institution. Again, there are numerous acceptable examples of when student data could need to be shared, including scholarships, college applications, and more. We believe this provision, again, places a burden on the tech provider to determine this criteria with limited and unclear guidance. And it's our belief that schools should be able to use educational technology solutions to improve student educational outcomes. We are concerned that the language found in this bill could ultimately limit student access to these solutions. And lastly, we would also concur and share the same concerns that was mentioned to Sarah's point on the requirement to establish written procedures that would be considered public information unless otherwise classified. We remain committed to working with the representative and related committees to identify a legislative solution that protects student data privacy. We would strongly recommend that this body look at SOPIPA, a model that has been enacted in 34 other states and includes several strong protections, such as the banning of sale of student data and targeted advertising in these services, requiring strong security procedures and practices, and the deletion of student data upon request by school. In addition, the model legislation actually, we believe, creates broader protections than what is included in the current draft. Thank you in advance for the consideration of these matters. We look forward to discussing with them in detail in the future.
Thank you for your testimony. With that, members, that wraps up our public testimony of folks who signed up. We'll move on to member discussion, but first, Representative Feist, if you want to respond to any of the testimony from the last couple of minutes, please go ahead.
Yep. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you all for the helpful input from the community, experts, stakeholders. And thank you to those who have already worked with me to amend the language as we are able to do and still in keeping with the purpose of this bill. This is a really important bill, and it's a very bold bill, but it's also a bill that has been around for the last, I believe, 6 years. And many stakeholders have had the opportunity to provide input. So while I understand that this bill represents, you know, change and it will create some requirements for the stakeholders, I'm completely comfortable with that. This bill is really important and it is time sensitive. Regarding the opt-out provisions, these used to be opt-in, and it was in accommodation to the school stakeholders that we changed it to opt out. In addition, there is language that says if applicable. So there are certain circumstances where opting out is impractical, and we understand that. Ultimately, we don't believe that parents are going to opt out in droves, but the fact that Education in Minnesota supports this bill tells me that teachers are not concerned that they might have to adapt their lesson plans to the changing world, which they already have so magnificently. Next, I just want to emphasize that schools can take possession of devices and search them. This bill does not impact that. What we don't want to do is have students being under constant surveillance remotely. And so I just wanted to emphasize that. And lastly, I understand that this might create some requirements and burdens on tech providers, and I'm comfortable with that. This bill is really important. It achieves an important goal of protecting our students, and Minnesota can take the lead and be bold and take this important step. So I appreciate all the input. I'm definitely happy to have conversations with folks. I'm willing to put in the effort. I've got a spreadsheet. I'm very organized. So people are welcome to reach out to me. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Feist. Representative Scott.
Thanks, Madam Chair. And I want to thank Representative Feist for her hard work on this. She has been far more patient than most people probably could have been with this issue. Like she said, she's very organized. She has a spreadsheet with everybody's concerns, who has the concerns, and she's been very accommodating. But what she just said is accurate. When it gets right down to it, this is about protecting students and empowering parents. And so if tech providers, if some of the schools have concerns, this bill used to be what? I wish Representative Lucero was still on our committee, but it used to be, I don't know, 15, 16 pages, and it's been whittled down to a few. So this bill has already been sliced and diced. And I don't know from a perspective to reach the goal of protecting students and empowering parents, I don't know what else really can be done except for some technical changes. And so I want to thank her for her work on this. I know she'll continue to be open to work with others. But the bottom line is she is not going to compromise what this bill ultimately is supposed to accomplish. And so, you know, people don't always get their way around here because sometimes there's a priority higher than pleasing certain groups. So thank you, Representative Feist, for what you're doing, and keep up the good work.
Thank you, Representative Scott. And I do think, so as chair of the Data Practices Commission, you know, there are very few things that that move in this body in any commission or council or task force where we have bicameral bipartisan support. And this was a bill that we all agreed on in the commission. Just to remind folks, Representative Herr, Representative Scott, Representative Lucero, and then our House delegation to the Data Practices Commission. And really appreciate the full testimony and discussions that we had in that commission as well. Members, is there any more discussion to the bill? I think Representative Scott and Feist summarized this very well. It's been going on for a very long time. So with that, any quick closing comments, Representative Feist? I know you just had the floor.
Yeah, thank you. I just think that COVID has made it clear we absolutely must protect student data. We need to be thinking proactively about the way that we surveil students when they're on school-issued devices. And it's just really important that we protect children and their emerging digital lives to get something done. I'm really, really proud to be working on this bill with so many stakeholders, and I would urge you to support it.
All right, with that, Representative Feist renews her motion that House File 341 as amended be referred to the Education Policy Committee. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Becker Finn.
Yes.
Representative Moeller.
Aye.
Representative Scott.
Yes.
Representative Feist.
Yes.
Representative Frazier.
Yes.
Representative Grossel.
Aye.
Representative Herr.
Aye.
Representative Hollins.
Aye.
Representative Johnson.
Aye.
Representative Liebling.
Aye.
Representative Long.
Aye.
Representative Mortensen.
Aye.
Representative Novotny.
Aye.
Representative Farr.
Aye.
Representative Robbins.
Aye.
Representative Vang.
Aye.
Representative Zhang. Representative Zhang. That is 16 ayes and no nays.
The motion prevails. House File 341 as amended is on its way to education policy. With that, we'll move on to another Representative Feist bill. Representative Feist, would you like to move that House File 2353 be referred to the General Register?
Yes, I would. So moved.
All right, Representative Feist, please go ahead with the presentation of your bill.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. This bill is way less complicated. This bill will make private the data collected by government entities that is considered education support services data. The impetus for this bill is the data that is being collected through facilitation of such services by Hennepin County to reduce disparities for the county's most vulnerable residents. These types of services are being considered by other counties in Minnesota as well. Hennepin County requested and received a temporary data classification of private data on individuals for program participant information. That classification will expire in August of 2022, this year. The next step in the process is to permanently classify this data as private on individuals. And the bill only is intended to make private the data on individual participants, not the program itself. The Education Support Services Program gets consent from the participant or their parents to coordinate with schools, child protection, juvenile probation, and both county attorneys and public defenders. Participants often need more than just school tutoring, but may also need transportation, stable housing, food assistance, childcare, et cetera, in order to perform better in class. The type of services being provided are voluntary and are intentionally placed outside of some of the mandated services such as child protection or juvenile probation. Much of the data provided by other county departments or state agencies is private, but since the county is then creating additional data about what services the student may need, it is no longer protected under current law. Some of the data created by the Education Support Services Department is sensitive. Individuals may be unwilling to participate in the program if the data was public. With me today is Krista Mims, the Director of Education Support Services Program, and Christy Lottie Johnson, the county's responsible authority and data compliance official, to explain more about the program and why this data should be kept private. Thank you.
All right. I'm not sure which one of them wants to go first, but whoever wants to go first, please introduce yourself for the record and then go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you. Good morning, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Krista Mims, and I'm the Director of Education Support Services at Hennepin County. I appreciate the time this morning to speak in support of this bill introduced by Representative Feist. Hennepin County is committed to reducing disparities, which diminish the life of our residents. Hennepin County's Education Support Services began in August of 2020. The department is housed within the county's disparity reduction line of business, outside of the welfare, justice, or other county systems, to intentionally empower youth and their families to choose the support they receive from education support services. The department strives to address the racial and educational disparities faced by youth who receive county services and address the academic achievement opportunity gap of county-connected youth. Educational support specialists provide support and resources with a focus on student empowerment, skill building, and collaboration with families, schools, and support professionals through educational navigation, advocacy, mentoring, and tutoring. This program strives to increase academic skills and educational outcomes for county-connected students in grades K through 12 and GED seekers who are disproportionately youth of color. Our team receives data from referring program areas within the county and from sources outside the county, including schools, other support professionals and agencies, and our tutoring partner. We provide a Tennyson warning to our participants and will only exchange data, including the initial referral, with the consent of the participant. We create data when assessing the strengths and needs of a student and family, developing support plans to promote ongoing academic goals and achievement, documenting reports of academic growth from our tutoring partner, and when receiving information from other partners supporting a family's educational needs. This bill will help to protect the data collected and created by Education Support Services, allowing us to continue to provide transformative services for youth and their families. Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My colleague, Christy Lottie Johnson, will provide additional context and information in her testimony.
All right, thank you. Ms. Lottie Johnson, please introduce yourself for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Christy Lottie Johnson, and I am the responsible authority and data practices compliance official for Hennepin County. I echo my colleagues' appreciation to Representative Feist for authoring this proposed legislation that we are here to discuss today. Ms. Mims has shared with you Hennepin County's approach to reducing disparities, especially in the area of education. She has also described the data collected and created by the Education Support Services Department. The Minnesota Government Data Practices Act allows for government entities to request a temporary classification of data in which similar data has been classified as not public or in which public access to the data would be rendered unworkable, a program authorized by law. The government entity must also clearly establish that no statute currently exists which either allows or forbids classification of the data as non-public. In September 2020, Hennepin County applied to the Minnesota Data Practices Office for a temporary classification for the participant data created by the Education Support Services Department. The request to have the participant data classified as private data on individuals was granted in November 2020. This temporary classification was communicated to the legislature by the Minnesota Data Practices Office in January 2021 as required by statute. We are now moving forward to have the data permanently classified as private data on an individual to address the August deadline for the expiration of the temporary classification. House File 2353, as introduced by Representative Feist, adds a new section to the broad category of family, welfare, and benefit data. Proposed section 13.463 defines education support services data and classifies the participant data as private data on an individual. Because participants and their families are referred from programs in which their data are classified as private data on an individual, we believe they would have the same expectation for their data held by the Education Support Services Department. If the data about the program participants and their family members are not classified as private, it is likely that youth, parents, or caregivers will choose to decline services, limiting the county's ability to provide supports to some of our most vulnerable residents. If the individual chose to participate in the program and the data created by the program is not classified as private, if requested, Hennepin County would be compelled to release the data, which could adversely affect the data subject's well-being or reputation. Thank you again for taking the time to consider this proposed legislation. My colleague, Krista Mims, and I are available for any questions you may have.
All right, thank you for your testimony. We'll move on to discussion, because I don't have anyone else on the list. Representative Johnson.
I'm sorry, it took me a moment to unmute. Overall, I think this data should be private and make sure it stays private, but I do have one concern. Reading the bill, there is no audit trails or any way to make sure that the data is being accessed properly according to statute. I'm just wondering if that plans to be put in, because I know this is going to the general register. And also, if there's going to, Chair Becker-Finn, if there's going to be an omnibus data practices bill, if this bill would be included, if it is, can we make sure that the audit trails are included to make sure the data is not being misused?
Representative Feist, any response?
Yes, I was actually hoping that Christy Lottie Johnson could respond directly. I know that audit trails are always a good idea in concept, but I'm not sure if they're practical in this instance, but I would refer to her expertise.
Ms. Lottie Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Johnson, thank you for that question. We are using technology that allows for audit trails, and we audit our use of data regularly across various technology platforms. I think one of the challenges with putting language specifically in this this new proposed language is that if we look at other parts of the Data Practices Act, like child protection under 463, or if we look at other sections around juvenile probation data, we don't have that same requirement for audit trails. And so adding it in to this specific section isn't really consistent with how we would be approaching data with other areas. And so that would be our one concern, is that there's the lack of consistency.
All right, thank you for that response. As far as whether there will be a data omnibus bill, remains to be seen. Conversations are ongoing with the Senate. Obviously, we were able to pass one last year, but the Senate wasn't interested in getting that accomplished last year. So we'll see. Maybe 2022 will be different. Any follow-up, Representative Johnson?
Chair Becker-Finn, members, I'm a little disappointed in that response. I believe we should always have audit trails in statute to make sure this data is accessed properly. Different individuals could have their own audit trails, but if we don't put it in statute, then I think all the data we need to have, we should look at a broad audit trail on all this data statewide. on everything, as there's other places that where data mining is going on illegally as well, throughout and with hackers and stuff. So we need to make sure that all this data on our children, especially the students, is accessed properly and only accessed when absolutely needed, without an actual audit trail that lets the legislator know that there's nothing improper going on. We will never know what's happening with the data of our children.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And my concerns, let me ask Ms. Lottie Johnson, who all will this data be shared with again, if you could refresh my memory?
Ms. Lottie Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Scott. The data is only shared with individuals that are that the participant or the participant's parent or guardian gives consent to. So I can't tell you like who it would be shared with for sure, because if the parent says, yes, I want you to share my information with the school, we would share it with the school, but we would not share the information with the school without their permission. We only take referrals if the parent or guardian or the participant agree to the referral in the first place. So if Child Protection says, we want to refer you to Education Support Services, they need to sign a consent and then the referral is made. So all of the data sharing that takes place with this program takes place only with consent.
Follow-up, Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm aware of that, but I think somebody mentioned all the different places that it could be shared, whether it's juvenile detention, social services. So what are the possible entities that it could be shared with if the parent consented to? What, name all of those if you could.
Ms. Lottie Johnson.
Representative, thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Scott. I'm actually going to have Krista Mims respond to that. She's the one who is the director of the department and she has that information.
Ms. Mims.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So those other entities within Hennepin County would be the referral source. So the ones guiding people into our program if they so choose. Some of those typical areas where we receive referrals from would be Child Protective Services, Children's Mental Health, Juvenile Justice, Child Access. So other kind of county areas where there may be an engagement with a young person, those would be the folks connecting them to our program.
Representative Scott.
Thanks, Madam Chair. So I think that just made the case for audit trails. And I apologize, I should have had an amendment, talk to the author, had that ready to go, and perhaps that can be added in the Senate since this is going to the General Register. But those are so many different agencies that could potentially be touching this information. And I know it's been stated that that's not required in other places. I don't care. And I have a bill being drafted right now that's going to fix that, because there are certain basic things that if these agencies want to be able to share the information, and if they think it's really beneficial to the subject of that data to have their information shared, then there's going to have to be audit trails. In this day and age with data breaches, there's not a good reason not to have them. And so, like I said, I don't care what's being done in other areas right now. We're adding audit trails as we go along with statute. So I have a bill that's going to address it more broadly. But I think that has to be part of this bill. It's just too many different agencies that are being, the data is being shared with. And if you already have the capabilities to create audit trails, then let's do it and have an annual or annual or biannual audit report to make sure that this data is not getting in the wrong hands and people aren't just creeping on it. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Scott. And for my own understanding, I want to make sure I understand the bill correctly, but the entities, Director Mims, that you just referenced, those would be the entities referring to you. They wouldn't necessarily be the entities that you would be then turning around and sharing all that data with. It's they're referring to your support services. Director Mims, if you could clarify that.
That is correct, Madam Chair. Those would be the entities, Hennepin County entities that are referring into our department.
Okay, thank you for that clarification. Any further questions from committee members? Representative Scott, I don't know if your hand is still up or if you have an additional comment. Okay, Representative Scott.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. So in many cases, though, it's going to be a two-way communication. And again, it's trust but verify.
All right. Thank you, Representative Scott. Any further discussion to the bill? All right. Representative Feist, any closing comments?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would urge committee members to support this bill as drafted. Perhaps audit trails will be added in the Senate. I feel comfortable with it as drafted and the reassurances from our experts that this data will be kept safe. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Representative Feist. And I mean, it isn't unheard of that we have amendments on the House floor as well. But I also support the bill in its current form. And with that, Representative Feist renews her motion that House File 2353 be referred to the General Register, and the clerk will take the roll.
Chair Becker-Finn.
Aye.
Representative Moeller.
Aye.
Representative Scott.
Not yet, no.
Representative Feist.
Aye.
Representative Frazier.
Aye.
Representative Grossel.
No.
Representative Herr.
Aye.
Representative Hollins.
Aye.
Representative Johnson.
No. Johnson, no.
Perfect. Johnson, no. Representative Liebling.
Aye.
Representative Long.
Aye.
Representative Mortensen.
No.
Representative Novotny.
No.
Representative Farr.
No.
Representative Robbins.
No.
Representative Vang.
Aye.
And Representative Zhang.
Aye.
That is 10 ayes and 7 nays.
All right, the motion prevails and House File 2353 is referred to the General Register. Next up today, we have House File 2945. It is a Representative Herr bill. Representative Herr, would you like to move your bill?
So moved, Madam Chair.
All right. Would you like your motion to be that it be referred to the General Register?
Yes, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you. Representative Herr moves 2945 be referred to the General Register. I understand there is an amendment and that Representative Herr, that is your amendment. Would you like to move your amendment and then explain it to us, please?
Yes, Madam Chair, I would like to move the amendment. And Madam Chair, this author's amendment, it's just a few changes. And this came about from talking with interested parties. It just helps narrow the scope of the access. It clarifies a term, and then it requires the authorizers to follow process. And so I ask the committee support this amendment.
All right, and for the record, it is the A1 amendment that Representative Herr has moved. Any further discussion to the A1 amendment? All right, all those in favor of the A1, please say aye.
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 Opposed? All right, the A1 amendment is adopted. Representative Herr, please present your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Committee. Thank you for hearing House File 2945. This legislation is a change to improve the efficiency of the hiring process regarding access to background check information. What this bill does is allows authorized law enforcement agencies of cities and counties to provide comprehensive criminal history information to city and county hiring officials requesting a background check instead of going through the BCA. A report which the law enforcement agencies of cities and counties already have access to and are already pulling when they run a background check. Current law only allows them to say yes or no if a candidate or employee passes the background check. This bill would allow those entities to give the entire report to the authorized hiring personnel. It is important to note that this bill does not create any new data access or any of the involved parties for any of the involved parties, but improves the process for both the city hiring and candidates for employment. Chair Becker-Finn, I do have two testifiers here today who can speak to the need for cities and counties to have access to full background check and how this change will improve the hiring process. With your permission, I would like to turn it over to my first testifier, Alex Hassel.
All right. Thank you, Representative Herr. I don't know what your title is. If you could go ahead and introduce yourself for the record and then go ahead with your testimony.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Herr and co-authors Chair Beckerfin, Representative Smoller, and Bonner for bringing HF 2945 forward for a hearing today. I'm Alex Tassel with the League of Minnesota Cities, representing 837 cities across the state. This bill arose out of cities looking to improve the process in which they receive background check information during hiring. Laura Kushner, the League of Minnesota Cities' Human Resources Director, will speak in a moment about the specifics of the bill, but I did want to share that this language was created in collaboration with BCA to allow a local government's law enforcement department to share criminal history information with their hiring officials rather than having them obtain a criminal history check on a candidate via BCA. I'd like to emphasize a point that Representative Hurst stated, that this bill does not provide any new data that wasn't accessible under current law, nor do any new people get access to this data, but it is a process improvement to increase the efficiency of hiring for both cities and candidates. I greatly appreciate you hearing this bill today, and I will defer to Laura Kushner for the bulk of our comments.
Thank you for your testimony. Ms. Kushner, please introduce yourself for the record and then go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think the first two testifiers did a great job of emphasizing that right now cities have two options to attain criminal history, and both of those options provide the same information. You can go to the BCA or you can go to your police department. The BCA is a great resource for cities, but it does require that they pay a fee and it does require additional processing time. So a lot of our cities like to go to their local PDs. Obviously that is no charge to them and that they can obtain the data, the criminal history data, more quickly. So the problem is the current statutory language, which can be interpreted to require the police department to only provide a yes or no, yes, hire this person, no, don't hire this person. And the reason that doesn't work is because the police department is rarely the hiring authority. The city might be hiring a maintenance worker or an office worker or an accountant or someone else. And so the hiring authority is the one who knows the job. They know what the job duties are. They know what kinds of criminal history would potentially bar a candidate from employment. And they know how to make those decisions about, you know, how much time has occurred since the person was hired or since the criminal history occurred, whether it's relevant to the job. So for example, if you have a DUI conviction for somebody who drives on behalf of the city, that definitely is something the city would want to look at. However, if you have a DUI conviction for somebody who is an office worker, it may not be that relevant to the job. And the hiring authority is the one that's best positioned to know when it's relevant and what it isn't. The only other thing I want to emphasize is just that this approach to evaluating criminal history background checks is very much in line with state and federal laws, which require cities to be thoughtful about when they reject a candidate on a criminal history background check. The EEOC requires you to look at time past and to treat each situation as a unique occurrence and to evaluate them on a case-by-case basis. So our cities are trying to follow the law, and this change in the statute will help with that. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
All right, thank you for your testimony. We do have one other member of the public signed up to testify. Mr. Neumeister, if you could introduce yourself and go ahead with your testimony.
Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Rich Neumeister. Criminal background checks, as you may know, Madam Chair and members of the committee, they're all over the state statutes. For specific positions or not. I looked at this statute and I did talk with folks from the League of Minnesota Cities, and I believe the amendment that is being offered clarifies. When I saw on the posting, there were two A1 amendments for the bill. Maybe I was looking at it wrong, but my understanding is that there's an amendment that clarifies hiring authorities. And then number two is that the individual gets notice pursuant to the chapter 364. Is that correct?
Representative Herr.
Madam Chair, it's actually both. All of those are included in the 1A1 amendment. The A1 amendment was actually the result of conversations with Rich and or Mr. Neumeister. And so line point 1.2 includes so that we can narrow who has access to it, that county and cities replace with hiring and licensing authority of the city and county, so that not just anybody within the city can. And then also, again, it's inserted in page 1, line 17, the same thing, hiring and licensing authority. And then on line 18, page 1, that's where we talk about, that's where the language refers to section 364.05, which is the notice that needs to be provided.
Madam Chair, thank you, Representative Herr. I do see that there is only one A1 amendment posted. I know there are quite a few other amendments for the other bills, so maybe that's where the confusion comes in. Mr. Neumeister.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I just also would like to say this is not just involving hiring. This is also involving licensing. Cities and towns and counties do a lot of their own little ordinances dealing with hiring and licenses. So, Madam Chair, those are my comments. I'm very much obliged to Representative Herr for having willing an open door to talk to myself and also Ms. Kao. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. That's all that I have on the list for public testifiers. I do know that we have folks from DPS and BCA available if members do have questions for them, but we'll move on to discussion. Representative Novotny.
Thank you, Chair. That was going to be my question. Is there somebody from the BCA online? And my question is, how much are these fees? And does the BCA have a concern about losing control of this information as opposed to being a single gate for this information so it can be controlled and monitored?
I have on the list Olivia Anderson from the BCA. If you could introduce yourself for the record and then go ahead with your response to Representative Novotny.
Hello, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Olivia Anderson, and I'm with the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. Background checks can currently go through local law enforcement, depending upon the legislative authority. So we don't have concerns with this process. This is a process that is currently in place. In terms of losing control of the data, there are still protections within this statute, as well as Chapter 13 and other statutes as to criminal history data. So those are not concerns that we have at this time.
Any follow-up, Representative Novotny?
Yes, thank you, Chair Finn, Becker Finn. The other question was cost. What is the cost of this? What are we trying to eliminate?
So the cost for
Ms. Anderson.
I'm so sorry, Chair.
It's okay.
Chair Beckerfin, members of the committee, cost for Minnesota only criminal history checks is $15.
You cut out there because I think Mr. Neumeister's mic came open. If you could re-answer that question, that would be great.
Yes, Madam Chair, members of the committee, a cost for a Minnesota only criminal history check is $15.
Follow up, Representative Novotny, and then we're going to move on to other members.
That's fine. Thank you, Chair.
All right. Thank you, Representative Novotny. Next on the list, I have Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to Ms. Kushner, I believe this question would be directed. So once a city or county entity gets this information, it's sent to you electronically, I'm assuming. And then where is that kept and how long do you keep it?
Ms. Kushner.
Madam Chair, Representative, thank you. The city, at least at the last time that I was part of this process, which has been a few years, I believe it was a paper copy, but they may have perhaps the Department of Public Safety, BCA can answer that better than I can. But it would be kept in the city in compliance with their records retention schedule. And it would be locked as, you know, appropriate confidential data.
Follow up, Representative Scott, or do you want to see if BCA has further response?
Not necessarily. I'm just wondering if maybe we could ask Mr. Hopkins with House Research, would this data automatically be classified as confidential, or does the legislature need to do that?
I think Mr. Hopkins is on. If you could introduce yourself and go ahead with your response.
Sorry, Chair Becker-Finn. Rep. Scott, could you specify what data are you referring to?
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So when this data comes into a city or county about a person's criminal background and the city or county keeps that, is it automatically classified as confidential data, confidential like personnel data, or does the legislature need to explicitly say that here?
Mr. Hopkins.
Madam Chair, Representative Scott. So if it is data on an applicant for employment, that would be classified as personnel data under 13.43. Personnel data is classified as private data on individuals unless it's specifically made public under that statute. I do not believe that background check data is made public. I will double check for you and let you know if that's not the case, but I believe it would remain private data on individuals because it's on an applicant for employment.
Follow up, Representative Scott, or does that cover it?
No, Madam Chair, so Mr. Hopkins, we don't need to explicitly say that here. It automatically falls into that category. Is that right?
Mr. Hopkins.
Madam Chair, yes, that is correct. I'm looking at 13.43 right now, which is the personnel data section. And background check information is not listed as one of the kinds of data that's made public under that subdivision. So for terms of hiring individuals, that would be private data on individuals automatically.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Hopkins. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do just have one question for you. I know that you, the motion was made to send this to the General Register, but we've had the BCA on this call. This is part of 299C in statute, and which deals with public safety and the BCA. And it seems to me that this should go to public safety because of that. So I don't know if you had a discussion regarding that, but it seems to me that that's where this bill ought to make a stop there.
Thank you for the question, Representative Scott. Because it is really about how data is being accessed and not so much about who has access to the data and any kind of criminal processes, you know, it's more of a human resources / data access issue is why I didn't feel that it needed to go to the Public Safety Committee. You know, we can disagree, I suppose, but you know, this really is not changing what data is available, but just changing a process. It's not changing who has access to the data. It's just how it's accessed, and that really felt like it fell within the realm of, you know, data and what we do in this committee.
Madam Chair.
Any further follow-up, Representative Scott?
And you're the chair, and you get to make that call. It just seems because it's in that section of statute, it just seemed to me that it should go to public safety. But thank you, Madam Chair.
Noted. Representative Long.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just had a brief question for Ms. Kushner. You had mentioned that this bill would allow for a more individualized assessment of potential employees. And given the worker shortage that we're seeing in the state, I'm wondering if the League of Cities views this as at least one potential way to help expand the pool of workers who cities might be able to hire for particular jobs.
Director Kushner.
Madam Chair, thank you. Representative, yes, we do encourage our cities to be very thoughtful about considering the criminal history background check, not only because it's the law, but because it will expand the pool of candidates. But they, of course, they need to do that in a thoughtful and careful way while protecting residents and, you know, members of the city, visitors, et cetera.
Any follow-up, Representative Long?
No, thank you.
All right. Thank you. Next on the list, and I will go to Representative Robbins, and I can't tell if Representative Johnson, in case his hand keeps going up and down, but we'll go to Representative Robbins and then Johnson if he wants to say anything, and then we'll go to the vote. Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Herr, for bringing this bill. I just had a question about the amendment as well for Representative Herr or for whomever. My concern is I was actually more comfortable with it when it said county or the city, but adding hiring and or licensing authority just raises some concerns for me, because I know counties in particular, they contract for services with dozens of providers, hundreds. And so would this mean anybody who works on a county grant can have access to this? And is that any, originally it was stated that there's no new people getting access to this data, which is very private for some people. So I just want to know if adding the hiring or licensing authority expands who would have access to this, and what sort of guardrails are around that. I think it was when it was narrowly tailored to city or county, that just seemed a little more appropriate. So I'm interested to know about this expansion. Thank you.
Representative Herr.
Thank you, Chair Barker-Finn, and thank you, Representative Robbins, for that question. I'll just say really quickly that saying city and county actually is quite expansive. That means that anybody who works for a city or county could request that. So I worked in the mayor's office. I did not hire anybody, but then I could have requested at any point a background check, criminal background check, and somebody, and it limits that because I'm not authorized in hiring in order to do that. And so this really does actually make the scope smaller than just stating city and county. And I would, and I will defer to Ms. Kushner on any additional thoughts she has around the licensing authority piece of it.
Director Kushner.
Madam Chair, Representative, I think a couple of things to note here. We would interpret that language as the hiring authority for the city or county, and that would not include independent contractors or anything like that. It would be city and county employees who are authorized to hire on behalf of that entity. And with regard to licensing, I can't speak to counties, but I know that cities are primarily doing licensing, like liquor store licenses and things like that. And I'll also just point out that these procedures have been in place for decades, and cities and counties have been using these procedures for decades. And we're just trying to clarify it to make it a little, to make the process better.
Representative Robbins, any follow-up?
Just briefly, Madam Chair, thank you. I appreciate that, Representative Herr and Ms. Kushner, and I would just encourage maybe a little more clarity to just say that it's city or county employees who have the hiring authority to keep that distinction that you've articulated in committee, because I wouldn't want it to get further afield that anyone you contract with who then hires for their own group would have that authority or that access as well. So thank you.
Thank you. And I will point out, if you actually look at the bill and hold it up with the amendment, the words city or county are still included. So it will read the hiring or licensing authority of the city or county. So I think that takes care of a little bit of that. I know it's difficult sometimes when you're going through between different windows and screens, but did want to point that out just for the record, that if you kind of read through it with the amendment, it does make more sense. Representative Johnson.
Chair Becker-Finn, I have two areas of concerns on this bill. The first one, Representative Robbins mentioned, because I know there's a number of cities that actually have members of the public on a hiring board. They would have access to this data. So I have concerns to make sure that the data is protected, because it can make it a huge thing. Another issue is we've had issues in where people come from out of state. Is this going to open up so the background checks can also be done, not just in Minnesota, but nationwide? Because we know we've had bad actors come into the state, get a license. We cannot look into other states where we would have found the issue going on, but because we don't have that data, it didn't occur in Minnesota, that background check didn't provide any of that information. And the third issue is this particular chapter falls under the BCA under the public safety. I'm disappointed that it's not going to public safety, because there is a huge public, besides the data, there's concern that that some of this data could be misused. And I think the Public Safety Commission committee needs to look at it to make sure that the data is not going in, is going to be used properly as well, and to get some understanding, because the sheriffs and the police departments need to know what they need to do, and I believe they should have some more input on the how those requests are going to be handled, because they are the ones that actually get in trouble if the data gets into the wrong hands, because they are responsible for that data. So I think we need to have the chiefs and the Sheriff's Association input on this as well, and we could do that in the Public Safety Committee.
I thank you for your comments. I do think if the question is how data is handled, that is fully in the jurisdiction of this committee. If there were other folks with concerns, this was a fully noticed hearing, and we would have been happy to have them participate in this discussion today. With that, no other hands up. Representative Herr, any final comments on your bill?
Thank you, Chair Beckerman. I just want to reiterate, I know that there was concerns around how this data is going to use, but I just want to remind the body that this data is already being pulled by the BCA and given to the hiring authority, who is now just asking for the same information from their own law enforcement entity. It is no new people, and it is the BCA, it's the same information the BCA is already pulling for those exact same people. And so just to remind us that there is no new information being put out there, because it is the same information, and there is no new access point because it is the same people who are already requesting it. There is no change in it except for who is pulling it and giving it to that same person. So I just want to remind us of this fact, because it is really important. And I just want to add really quick that both the sheriffs and the chiefs are actually okay with this. There's no concern from them. This actually came out of a lot of collaboration with different groups and entities who are all involved in this process. It was, you know, put past the ACLU, Minkoji looked at it. We took, you know, Mr. Neumeister's recommendations on including the amendments. And so there's many people that have been involved in this process. And so the concerns that we have, again, no new information is being accessed. It's already being given right now to those entities for the exact same reason. And so with that, Madam Chair, I would like to renew my motion that House File 2945 as amended be recommended to pass and place in the general registry.
Thank you, Representative Herr. And I also meant to note, generally, if you have criminal convictions, those are already public. You could probably go look it up from your computer right now if you wanted to. This is just a matter of making things more efficient for everybody who needs this information. Representative Herr has renewed her motion. And with that, we'll move on to the vote. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Beckerfin.
Aye.
Vice Chair Mueller.
Aye.
Representative Scott?
Aye.
Representative Feist?
Aye.
Representative Frazier?
Aye.
Representative Grossel?
Aye.
Representative Herr?
Aye.
Representative Hollins?
Aye.
Representative Johnson?
Aye.
Representative Liebling?
Aye.
Representative Long?
Aye.
Representative Mortensen?
Aye.
Representative Novotny?
No.
Representative Farr?
Aye.
Representative Robbins?
Aye.
Representative Vang?
Aye.
And Representative Zhang?
Aye.
That is 16 ayes and one nay.
All right, the motion prevails and House File 2945 as amended is on its way to the general register. We'll see how fast we can get to House File 2354. I will move Representative Feist's bill, House File 2354, and then I will move the A1 amendment, which I believe is just updating the dates. Representative Feist, if you could quickly just confirm that that is what the A1 amendment does.
That is correct.
All right. Thank you, Representative Feist. Any discussion to the A1 amendment to House File 2354? All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? All right, the A1 amendment is adopted. So I will move that House File 2354 as amended be referred to the General Register. Representative Feist, please present your bill.
Yep. Thank you, Madam Chair. This bill provides a simpler and less costly means of enforcing Canadian court judgments for money by establishing an administrative procedure to register the final order of a Canadian court with a Minnesota clerk of court rather than initiating a new lawsuit. It was brought to me by Uniform Law Commissioner Robert Tennyson. He's available to answer any questions if there are any. And that's my presentation.
All right. Thank you, Representative Feist. Yes, members, it is the Bob Tennyson, but we will not go down that rabbit hole for our purposes today. He is available here for questions. Members, any discussion to House File 2354 as amended? All right. Seeing none, any closing comments, Representative Feist?
This is a good bill. Just good governance, housekeeping, creating more streamlined, efficient, cost-effective processes. So I would encourage everyone to support it.
Yeah, everyone knows we love the Uniform Law Commission in this committee. Thank you, Mr. Tennyson, for being available, even though we didn't need you. With that, I will renew my motion that House File 2354, as amended, be referred to the General Register. The clerk will take the roll.
Chairbreaker Finn.
Aye.
Vice Chair Moeller.
Aye.
Representative Scott.
Aye.
Representative Feist.
Aye.
Representative Frazier.
Aye.
Representative Grossel.
Aye.
Representative Herr.
Aye.
Representative Hollins.
Aye.
Representative Johnson.
Aye.
Representative Liebling.
Aye.
Representative Wong.
Aye.
Representative Mortensen?
Aye.
Representative Novotny?
Aye.
Representative Farr?
Aye.
Representative Robbins?
Aye.
Representative Vang?
Aye.
And Representative Zhang?
Aye.
Perfect. That is 17 ayes and no nays.
All right. The motion prevails and House File 2354, as amended, is moved to the General Register. Thank you for speeding up your speaking speed so we could get through all of that today, Representative Feist. I do think we had some good discussion today. Really appreciate members being engaged in the work that we're doing. We've had a very successful Tuesday morning. So good job, everybody. And thank you for your commitment to this work. With that, we are adjourned.